I'm recording now. That's all you meant.
Right. Thank you, Brandon. First off, where is my sponsor? That's a big shot right there. I know his home group is tonight, so I'm just messing with it. Again, my name is Matt Lanchin. My sobriety date is 6:30 of 22. My home group is at the Discovery Club at 7 a.m. on Saturdays. I have a sponsor, and he has a sponsor, and he has a sponsor, and two of those three are on this call right now, and that's really cool. I was going through, I've been rehearsing this in my head for a week now. And I realized, like, yesterday, after talking to literally every single one of my sponsees, that it's gonna go absolutely nothing like I had it completely written out, and at least for noting it. So I'm glad I didn't go with that plan. There's a lot of different places in the book where it talks about, what it was like, what happened, or what I was like, what happened, and what I am like now. And my favorite thing on starting, I decided this. On starting a speaker meeting, and it says, faced with an alcoholic destruction, we soon became open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol, heroin was a great persuader. It finally beat me into a sense of reasonableness. Sometimes this was a tedious process, and that tedious process is the first part of my story. I guess it's logical to start at childhood. I don't go into that really. Like, I think there's a cool duality between 12-step recovery and therapy, and I don't mix the two together until I'm fully engulfed in each and I'm able to find peace with it. So if I'm going to start somewhere like controversial, that I don't bring, childhood stuff into AA and vice versa up until I've completed the work in both and they come together quite beautifully with that duality. So we'll skip ahead to my adolescent years, which was, I think I can describe as the worst time of my entire life. So I was, I don't know, I was severely overweight and severely insecure. And like one of my earliest memories, like trying to figure it out, is how all these people had friends. Like people just had, people to sit with at lunch, and like people naturally gravitated to them. And that wasn't me. Like I was the type, like I just immediately realized that I had to be somebody else to make friends. And I would say like the weirdest shit too. I would meet somebody and be like, oh, tell me about yourself. And they're like, oh, my family's, they are refugees from Haiti. And I'd be like, oh my God, me too. We should sit together at lunch and talk about that boat ride with one another. Or fake sports and talk about Shaquille O. Jackson playing baseball or just anything. Just please just pay attention to me. Like it was something that was very hard. Up until 14, to where, like, I guess I should go back. Junior high, the first time I ever bought weed, I got expelled from school. So like my first introduction into trying anything, any substance, like was immediately consequence to it. And that made it a little bit harder as I was switched back to a Catholic school I hadn't been to since like third grade. And high school went pretty normal from there. Like I became a little bit more popular in high school because like it was always a contest to who had the least creepy old guy that would buy you alcohol and you could go to their house and be somewhat safe. And I tend to always have the least creepy of people that would let a bunch of 14-year-olds drink at their house. And I bring it back to it, one of those houses was like the first time I had mixed two substances. I was 14. I remember what music was playing. I remember what I was drinking. I remember who was there, and mixing Seagram's and weed was like this moment of like everything was going to be okay in my life. And I chased it for so long. I progressed to high school, did all the fun high school stuff, got expelled again my senior year for blowing a .27 at a football game. And then moved on to college, where I crossed the invisible line very quickly with the introduction of cocaine. And actually, specifically, once I figured out you can smoke cocaine. So it became like this teeter-totter process of trying to remain functional and working a job and going to college full time, and somehow I was able to graduate. I had started working at a paint store when I was 16, I think, and was basically given the keys of the business by the time I was 20. And they worked with my schedule. It was like family. It was probably one of the, the my favorite jobs I had until my addiction really, really kicked in. So I got married, had a kid. And the whole time I was hard, I had these secret addictions the entire time. I found it was pretty easy to quit drinking and cocaine with the introduction of Vicodin and every opiate I could find. That was much more manageable to make it across my days. And with that, I lost that job at the age of 23 with a pregnant wife, because it was brought to light that, my business plan, which included just stealing all of his product and selling it at half price, was not appreciated. I was fired, and I acted like every alcoholic. I called him and yelled at him and said, "You can't tell anybody. It's slander. It's libel." And then I would call back crying, saying, "I've been with you for 8 years," and it was this giant mess, And then I was able to land on my feet very quickly. And so far I had been, expelled from school twice and lost the first job I ever had as a result of drugs, and I'm only 23. So I got a job working in apartment maintenance. That job is, I'm really grateful for that job today. I can fix basically anything around my house. The problem is they gave a drug addict the keys to 500 different apartments with people living in them. So, like, I think I immediately just realized that the second I go into apartment, I go straight for the medicine cabinet, or I would steal quarters. I would replace drugs with lookalike drugs. And then sometimes, if I found a big enough one, I would just steal everything they had and kick the door in so it didn't look like somebody with keys did it. And the whole time they're asking me about it, and they're like, "You were, and I'm not careful, right? Like, I'm in this apartment doing a maintenance call, and 3 weeks later, everything is missing in their apartment." But they could never prove it. And so I like really went on this really dangerous line of I need these to be okay, and basically to block out like the absolute harm I was doing to everybody. This was a time in my addiction, with the cocaine use and that, where like I didn't have any language to put to drug use. It was just simply, I have a craving. I have, what I now call, an obsession. And the only way to stop that was to use something. And I ended up getting a job at a high school for being a janitor on second shift. And it was a union job. And my daughter was like, I got the job the day she was born. And with that job, it got a little bit harder to get drugs, apparently, when there's nobody to steal them from. Enter child, and so I started slowly draining our savings account because I'd always been financially in charge and the breadwinner through, that one decent job and selling drugs and all that. My wife is distracted with a child, and so, I would use pretty regularly, but not always, until that line was actually caught and cut off. Which entered the next darkest days of I needed something to be okay. I didn't feel good in my own skin. Not using something wasn't an option. And I discovered while I was working in the high school that if you huff air duster, it gives you a decent enough high to where it fills that craving. It was, I would randomly find myself passed out on hall, in the hallways of a high school floor, coming to, wondering, I knew what happened, but like how long I had been there, who had walked by. It was this absolutely terrifying point of my life. And I lost that job. I ended up just crashing out in a classroom, and my supervisor found me. And at first he didn't really realize what was going on because I had like collapsed onto a bed and I said I fell. He went to get help and I was in a blackout, and he came back and I was literally holding the nozzle in my mouth, blacked out on the floor again. And so I was subsequently fired from that job. Kind of. I was a union, so it was very hard to get rid of me. So that was a big blow to my new family, you know. And of course I didn't tell anybody. I said he was picking on me. I said I fell and they didn't want any of the insurance stuff, and I concocted this lie that I don't think anyone believed in. And so it was kind of like, okay, something's going on to my wife, my parents. There's constant, insecurity around, is Matt okay? Is Matt not okay? And so I had this hearing for the school board, and and I got a DUI on Duster on the way home from hearing that they were going to dismiss me. And that one really put me on the rocks. I had another experience, and this used to be one of those stories I shared in rehab, smoking cigarettes out with the guys on who has the most messed up story in rehab. But I was at Walgreens parking lot doing what I did because it's the only thing I had available, and I had consumed so much that I ended up soiling myself, passed out in a car. And when the police came, nobody wanted to put me in their squad car. You know, keys were in the ignition, car's running. And so they sent my mother-in-law home for to come pick me up, where I had been missing for 3 hours, and my wife had assumed that I had ended my life. And so I used that again, being caught, that I was actually, I concocted this story that I was attempting suicide, which was not true. But I can't be in trouble. I can't have a problem. Everyone has to feel sorry for me. And so that got me into treatment the first time. And I was there for a couple weeks. Insurance bounced me. I wasn't allowed to come home yet. Got a DUI on Air Duster a week after coming home from treatment into my second one, and proceeded to sit in jail for like 2 weeks into on a $300 bond because my parents felt I was safer in jail with a bunch of criminals than left to my own demise, you know. And that was one of those moments that was just awful. So anyway, I ended up in Gateway. I went through treatment. I got a sponsor. You know, I'm an in and out person in the program at this point. You know, I was sober from like, not really. I was sober. People thought I was sober from 2012 to 2017. I would take a break every year and a half or so and use some cocaine or take some pills. And, and about this time I had started working at a pawn shop and was very good at my job and pretty wildly successful at that too. And I got into, the only relationship that I know is a toxic relationship. And so, like, yeah, bring it on. You know, this is the only thing I know. That preceded me to be in a re to relapse and to discover heroin during that relapse, in which, the relationship was broken. Neither of us were healthy. She ended up cheating on me with one of my best friends in AA at the time, and it was this whole ordeal. And luckily, without that happening, I hated him. But without that happening, I never would have got out in that relationship, you know. And then I got with my current wife, Annie, and things were okay for a little bit. I wasn't working a program, you know. I was going to meetings this whole time. I had worked like steps 1 through 5, had a really strong AA Springfield's really good about fellowship and not so good about steps. And I didn't realize how important they were because nobody was there to tell me. About a year into the relationship with Annie, I picked up, started using heroin again, and I just a bunch of, what anyone who uses heroin knows the stuff that proceed that happens while you do that. And so from 2019 to 21, I don't know if I ever had 60 days. In that time, I started counting my time. Every time I'd restart my time, every time Annie caught me, instead of like when I was actually getting sober. Like I felt hopeless. I would still go to meetings if I was using. Hell, I took some people through the steps, a few of them at least, while I was actively using too. But I had to keep this thing that everything's okay, that nothing is wrong, and this whole fake life going on. And And it was awful, you know, it was awful. And I thought I was hopeless. You know, my last big run, you know, and this is after I had got a psychiatrist and tried meds. I had been on Vivitrol, I've been on Suboxone, I've tried going to meetings and counseling and outpatient, you know, and I still had this thing inside of me that would not turn off, you know, and the whole time, you know, I'm oblivious to what the real problem is. You know, everyone's saying to look at my job and to be honest. And I didn't know how to do that. You know, I was working in a job where I felt like I was this Billy, you know, this kingpin in Springfield of the stolen goods market. And no one could touch me and cops couldn't touch me. And, you know, and like the reality is I'm buying like stolen Legos from Walmart, you know, and making a lot of money doing it. And that's how cool I thought I was. My last run was 2021. It was for, and this is where I've heard Tarek's story before, and it's so funny when you talk about the craving, because this craving began in March or April, and I had made the decision that I was going to start using meth and not heroin because I didn't want to be physically dependent on it. And there was no option of not using drugs. And so I had this flawless thing that I would start using meth. At the time, I was on second chance probation because I had picked up some felonies while at work because I felt I didn't have to tell the truth to cops if they came in. I lost my train of thought there. There was oh, I was on probation and I got a letter saying my last appointment with my probation officer was in August, you know, and at that time, you know, immediately when I started doing meth, I immediately picked up doing heroin again, or Percocet at the time, or fentanyl, whatever the hell it was, with the thought, you know, and this is like May, that I was going to use for a month or two and I was going to be able to taper myself down and I was going to be able to make this probation appointment and pass the drug test and get my felonies dropped. And so, like, I don't know, 2 days before the probation appointment, like, you know, I'd been using pretty heavily and it was pretty apparent. And I was stuck and, you know, and I was just miserable. I was, no matter how many drugs I put in my body, I kept feeling more empty, more afraid, more alone. You know, and the whole time, you know, Annie's there on my side, and we've tried all these methods of drug testing and searching and, you know, and everything we try just to keep Matt sober. But the end of it was this, you know, this point where I can't describe the desperation and the confusion around not, you know, getting your favorite drug and it not producing the effect that it has for the last 20 years. I remember we were sitting around all weekend. I was, you know, I was miserable, and Annie was just loving me to, you know, not loving me to death in a bad way, but just loving me, knowing she can't do anything until I'm ready. And we had decided we're going to stay home all weekend and shut all the blinds and play video games. And the whole time I'm using, knowing I got probation, just miserable. And I had this voice inside me the whole time. It was like, just tell her, just tell her, you know, and I shake off voices like that because that's insane. Why would I be honest? You know, I've been in two, three other relationships, including Annie, to where at some point in the relationship, I'm literally sitting in a kitchen table with the person I'm in a relationship, and they're like, "Hey, we love you. We think we're going, something's going on. We think we, you know, if something's going on, we can get you some help and I love you." And the whole time I turn it and gaslight them and come up with all these reasons. And, you know, and every time I had gotten clean before or stopped using, I was always caught. You know, I never once was honest about it until like I was caught dead in hand. And this time it was different. Like I was hopeless. I was like, you know, I view it and I realize now, like, that's the true definition of unmanageability. Like going through divorce and losing jobs and getting arrested, like that's just stuff that happens, right? Like that has no tie. You know, I just wasn't careful enough, or I was being watched too hard, and I would, you know, I would fare better a lot next time. And this time I didn't have anything in me because I had finally had that moment to where the drugs aren't working. And if the drugs aren't working, what am I gonna do? You know, every time I would pick back up, like I knew the drugs would work. And now there's a maybe in there. And I didn't know how to handle that. And so, you know, I had pulled Annie aside and I was like, hey, I need to talk to you. You know, I'm stuck, I'm on drugs, you know. And she was like, oh my God, I can't believe that your behavior or your pupils haven't told me that at all, right? No, like she was distraught. And she was, you know, and I ended up in the Bluff, which was just a magical experience in itself. Like I was on a plane the next day. It wasn't as smooth. I'm gonna skip over that part because I was awful up until the point that she could get me on that airplane and to the Bluff. And, you know, and I went there and, you know, of course I'd been in AA for the last 10 or 8 years, been to all these meetings. And hadn't done shit, but literally thought I had worked the program. And so I expressed that sentiment one day in a group with Brandon Scarborough. And he was like, oh, cool. Let's talk outside a group. And so I went outside with him and expected to be able to, you know, explain to him how I'm hopeless and AA doesn't work and nothing works. And I'm the special type of drug addict because I've never been able to stop and I've done absolutely everything. So of course he turned to like page 86 and he was like, so you've done this every single day? Like, and of course I'd never seen that before in my life. I was like, is that new? You know, and he talked about my amends and having sponsees and being honest. And I was just like, no. You know, and I stayed there and there was this group of guys working in there. Like I know everyone might feel that way or in treatment, but at the time working there, it was Jay and Brandon, Satcher, Nikki J, Jonathan, Roe. Like I was there with a solid group of people, the majority of whom being are heroin addicts. And in Springfield, we don't have any sober heroin addicts. Like we don't have that type of thing to look up to. And so it was kind of this thing to where I started paying attention. And I ended up talking to Jay a lot because I'd had this job and Annie had not so nicely expressed that she hated my job and I needed to quit it. But like, I've been offered that before. What are we going to do for money? Like, I have to have this job. And so someone said, hey, talk to Jay. And so I caught Jay outside and I explained the situation and I can't even remember the conversation, but Jay has that experience doing that same thing. And so I was like, oh, okay, I'll take that in consideration. The whole time I'm having these little nudges of, I shouldn't be here. I hate my job. I'm never going to be able to stay sober. And mixed with family group, mixed with, you know, like the hope of like somebody had left a high paying job and was okay today. That was a big thing for me. I remember another group with Jay. It was an amends group, and I shot up my hand. And I had these sponsors before, and I was like, "So I've stolen $50,000 from his business, and he fired me, and the cops are investigating me, and I feel like shit." My last sponsor said I shouldn't make it unless I have $50,000, which was like cool because I basically knew I was gonna never have $50,000. And Jay's like, "No, I think you make that amends. Like, I think it's this and this and this." And I was like, "Oh, cool. I'm never going to ask you to be my sponsor. And I can't wait to get out of here." So, you know, I went through that and I got out and I called Jay. You know, I'd read through a little bit of Big Book Awakening and I was kind of opening up. I was not so sure on my core belief that I know everything and I'm smarter than everyone else. You know, and Jay took me, you know, we took the steps together. And you know, and at first I was real gung ho. You know, I was on this meeting the first, I think, December that we had it, and I was on fire. You know, I had end up, you know, and Jay's a real soft sponsor. You know, I remember calling him this one time, and he's like, I was like, I'm gonna make amends to, you know, my daughter's mom. And he's like, oh, cool. What did she say in the approach? And I was like, oh, I didn't make an approach. I'm just gonna spring it on her. And I think his soft approach to that suggestion was, no, you're not. You're going to text her right now and you're going to let her know what she's walking into. And I was like, oh, I think he's trying to tell me something here. You know, like I am not sure, but we should take a look at that. And I ended up making amends to her. And what came up in that situation to where I had made amends for being awful in court and using drugs and ruining our family and baiting her into court and being terrible. And when in turn I asked her like what I could do for her, or did I leave anything out? She says, "Yeah, that day you left the house and we couldn't find you was the worst day of my life. That they found you at the Walgreens parking lot, you know, the situation that was my old joke for treatment on how I crapped my pants and got out of a DUI, you know, was something that she has been in therapy for years, and she can't drive by Walgreens without having a flashback and somewhat of a panic attack. And she thought she had lost her husband and her daughter was going to grow up without a dad." And I was just floored. Like, and I felt awful. Like, oh my God, I've been making a joke of this my whole life and have not actually realized. Like, I did not expect her to bring that up. And so, you know, and I had, you know, and asked her what I could do to make it right, you know, and for years we had been, you know, I'd been lying to her, anyone with me had been lying to her that I wasn't relapsing, did not mess up my custody. And so she wanted to say if I relapsed, to let her know so she can be a part of it. And I was okay with that because I was going to stay sober forever for the rest of my life, and so that's something I wasn't going to have to worry about. And so fast forward a few months and I start getting disconnected. I had been in grad school, not taking care of myself, and started getting overwhelmed. And this whole time, like, I left the bluff without any secrets, and I started picking up secrets, and I started picking up process addictions, and I started hiding money to partake in those addictions. And I knew I was going to get caught because I had a credit card in my name we were making payments to, and it was just a matter of time for Annie to ask me to look at it, and it would all be brought out. And so, living in that dishonesty and fear, one Sunday night, I just had to thought like, "Hey, I'm gonna do drugs. I'm gonna do heroin tomorrow, and I'm just gonna do it once and get rid of this." And it made perfect sense. And there was no consequence. I'll go out in my life. I just need it. I used for 2 days, and the or about a week, I think. Actually, the timeline's real messy right now. But one night I had used the night before and I couldn't sleep. I wasn't withdrawing. It was just in that weird stage of not sleeping. And I had used, I decided I was just going to take a bump. It was like 1:30 in the morning. Probably did the smallest amount of heroin I've put in my, you know, in my body ever, you know, and I did it and I laid down in bed, you know, and the next thing I knew it, I was surrounded. I could only hear radios, you know, and Annie has described it to me as she woke up because I wasn't breathing. You know, if anyone doesn't hear God in that story, like, that's not usually a really loud event. But within minutes of me taking it and stopping breathing, she was awake and had tried everything and the cops and every, you know, and I was out. You know, they finally got me back with enough Narcan. And I was blind for 2 hours because I had lost so much oxygen. You know, I came to in the hospital. My sponsee was there, Stephen, you know, and Annie was there. And like, I was just one of the most demoralizing things of my life to be in that position, you know. And I got back with Jay, and then we, you know, and I was like, "Do we start over?" And he's like, "You know, we need to look at your dishonesty, and you need to make your amends." And so I did, and I took off on it, you know. And it was a hard time for the family. The whole family is traumatized from that situation, you know. And it's something we're still working through today. You know, and some of the things in those amends are, you know, like, it's going to take a lifetime to do. One of the big things is Jay always telling, you know, I went through the steps and I made some amends, and it's always one of the first things Jay told me was to pay attention to anything, just pay attention to what the universe is telling me. And at 2 months sober, I don't know what that looks like. I can pay attention to what you're telling me. I can take some suggestions, but I don't know that. I don't have that intuition, and I don't know what that's like, you know. And at this time, I was working at a homeless shelter because I quit my job to be of service in every way possible. You know, it's a shortcut I decided for recovery and service work, and I can do both and be totally in it. And I was miserable. I had this boss that I did not get along with, and she did certainly did not respect that I was the smartest person in the world with the best ideas that she's ever heard. And I didn't get along with her too well. And I was promised this probation job, and I didn't get it. And like, I felt hurt, I was destroyed, I was angry. And I was like it for a weekend, and then a Sunday morning I woke up and this thought was implanted inside of me before I even had a chance to think or breathe. You need to make amends to your old boss at the paint store, right? It's something I hadn't experienced yet. Like, if I want good things to happen and, you know, in my vocations, I need to clear up the damage from it. And so I told a bunch of people, like, for accountability, because I know how I changed my mind. And, you know, I called Jay and got the suggestion, and we figured out how much money. I got with Annie to make sure that was okay. You know, I'm getting ready to do the amends for God, for some godforsaken reason. I called Tarek, who gave me the suggestion of not ever mentioning drugs and alcohol during this amends. And Jay might have told me it too. I just didn't hear it because I was real excited. And Tarek was like, "You were absolutely not to say this. This was selfishness and dishonesty." And that was a real, like, I was like, "Oh my God, he's going to think I actually did it. You know, I don't have anyone to blame." Like, God. And so I drove there, you know, I texted him an approach and he thought about it and he said, "Meet me on Saturday." And I ended up going back to that store. That I got fired from like 12 years before. And I sat down with him and I owned up what I did. And I let him share how it affected him and his business. And I gave him at the end of it the $5,000 money order. And he just changed. He was like, "Oh my God, like this is legit." And I'm like, "Yeah, like I'm not here doing lip service." And he's like, and he, you know, and it was cool. And he shook my hand and, you know, I went about my way. You know, feeling pretty good. I've been paying him $100 a month ever since. I put Matt Lanchon amends on every single check that he receives. I made amends to his wife too, who was this really nice Christian lady, and so I assumed that one was going to be a breeze. I was wrong there. She proceeded to tell me how I had affected their family, how Greg had never hired another manager after me, how their kids have grown up with an absentee father, their house wasn't paid off. But all the regret in the world wouldn't bring back the time that they missed with their, you know, and he's like 75 years old and he had kids when he was like 60. And so, and that was hard. And that was one of those things. And it was like one of those moments to where, like, you know I cause harm, but like I finally realized like the harm that I caused as a result of my addiction affects generations of family. Like there's a ripple of harm going through it that not only affects the person, it affects their kids, it affects their business. And like, that's a big shoe to fill, you know? And that really, like, for one, it was an awful thing to sit through. I think I told somebody that, and they're like, "That is a great thing to sit through. That is what you need to hear to not go back to that type of life." I know it was somebody on this call because nobody else talks to me like that. And so it was just another thing to where my job's improved since that. And it's been really cool. You know, this whole time I hadn't talked to my dad for like 2 years and I had been doing all this therapy work on it. And I started showing up like him at home. I started being really angry and impatient and judgy and short and basically shitty with the people I love. You know, and Jay brought it to my attention again. You need to make amends. You know, you need to take a look at this amends with your dad. And I, you know, at this point, I had given it enough space to where I think it was more scared to do it than I was actually still resentful and holding on to anybody. You know, and I was told to meditate with that card in my hand and to only pray and think about my actions as a result of that. And I did it for like a week. You know, and we hadn't spoken or texted for 2 years. And at that following Saturday morning, Annie received a text from him, you know, expressing regret about how he handled the situation, expressing that, you know, that even though I won't talk, he wants to know that he's sorry and this and that. And like, she was real reluctant to tell me about it. And the second she did, and I said, "Well, there it is. Like, I have to, this is it. I'm making, you know, I mean, I'm paying attention now, finally." And I texted him right away and I set up for that weekend and we sat down and I, you know, addressed the dishonesty and the stealing and the shame I bring to the family and the forgetfulness and every unintentional harm and intentional harm that I'd placed on him. And we had a great conversation. He also, you know, and I went and asked him, like, "What can I do to make it right?" And he said he wants a relationship. And then he backtracks it. You know, my dad's a boomer Catholic German, so feelings aren't in their language and probably will never, but he's like, "But we don't have to talk every week." Or do something like that. I just want a relationship. And I couldn't believe I said, no, Dad, that's exactly what we need to do. Like, that's what a relationship looks like, is we talk and we do this, And I'm still get mad at him to this day about other stuff too. But he's who he is and I'm who I am. He doesn't have to change. It's how I perceive it. I finally feel like I'm a 38-year-old when I'm with him. And so that allows a lot of healing too. And that's been, this amazing thing too. And that's not the only thing, and I don't know if this is connected, but I decided it sounds like a really cool story to share from a podium. I hadn't been to my first big FU to my dad was stop going to Catholic Church. And I would never ever go back again. And after I made that amends, and I meditate every morning, and I am just listening, and I am praying about my little plans and designs, and I started popping up, I need to go to church. And I was like, that's weird. I'm not telling anyone that, that's a fluke. And it kept coming up, and it kept coming up. And I was like, not only did I feel like I needed to go to church, I needed to go back to the Catholic Church. And I told Jay to hold me accountable because I knew ego was going to creep in and try to protect me from doing anything healthy or worthwhile or growing. And he texted me every day, and I haven't missed a Sunday in church since that. And I feel at home, and I go early to meditate. I don't necessarily align with all Catholic beliefs, but I've never felt sufficient in my time for acknowledging the life I have today that my higher power has given me. And at least for that hour, hour and a half on every single Sunday, like, I know that's exactly why I'm there. And that's, and that's who I want to be. And I don't know how long it'll last, but like, it just keeps happening. That stuff, like, I used to pray for God to show up. And I swear to God, my prayers now are for God to stop showing off, because like, it has been one ride after another throughout my entire sobriety. And things at home have improved. We're able to communicate. We've worked through a lot of the stuff. And I can't say enough things about my wife, and I'm not doing it to score brownie points when I get off of here. Like, for someone to stick with me, one time she asked me, like, what's the most, like, what is the biggest act of affection that I've ever displayed for you? And I didn't even think about it. I said, you stayed, my entire life, and not that anyone else should have, you know what I mean? I was sick and I would drag everyone down, but she stayed through it all, and she loved me through it, and I'll never be done making amends to her. But I'm also probably not done creating harm in my home. I am human, but I'm very quick to clean it up these days. God, I don't know. I don't have a lot of time left, but it's just, thinking about this talk last week, this last Thursday, I woke up and I was really sad about something that happened on Masters of the Air on Apple TV on Friday nights. One of my favorite characters did not have a good outcome, and I was sad. And I woke up the next morning and I was even sadder. So I did the what everyone would do. I just went ahead and Googled the outcome of the show to feel better, because I have to know everything to be okay. I know that's on that sheet that Jay gave me at the end of my fifth step. But I proceeded to go to, my meditation room, and I just started thinking about this talk and everything I've been through and how I feel today, and my sacred holy time in the morning, and and just going blank and just being wide open to hear the message. And I couldn't even meditate. I sat there and wept for about 15 minutes, and for the first time in my life, I wasn't depressed. I wasn't sad. It wasn't regret, but it was just gratitude, and for the first time, I didn't fight back at it. I didn't wonder why. I sat up after about 5 minutes and just acknowledged that this is the experience that I'm supposed to be having today, and these are the feelings I'm supposed to feel. And I told a lot of people about it. I'm trying to get better about opening up about the good and the bad and every feeling I have, because that's brand new behavior for me. I go sideways a lot too. About twice a year, I get really depressed. I just go dark, and I could be doing everything right. My feet are moving, I'm doing all the stuff, and just something hits me. And It hit me real hard a couple of weeks back based on, fear of something at work, which was a fancied, we can tally this thing up to fancied, but it had a real effect on me, and I went dark and I start thinking about death and I took a day off work to basically sit in my shit, and on that day, eight people called me. I don't think I did an inventory the night before, but eight separate people called me that day throughout the day out of nowhere, not necessarily to check on me, just calling because that is the pattern. I talk to at least five to six people every day. This morning, four people called me before I got to work at 8 a.m., and I was able to watch it out. I've shared on this meeting before that, that doing the 11th step and the meditation in the morning, that's my first watch of the day. That's the first part of step 10. Before I leave my house, I have an opportunity to pay attention at where I'm at and how I'm feeling and what I can do. And I can take that into discussion immediately before I even set forth out the door. And that day that I went dark, I talked about it with every single person who called me, because that's what I've been trained to do. I've been trained to cut up my problems into as many little pieces as possible to take away the power, to break it up, and to seek perspectives on it, and even though I didn't have this like great effect from it, like the next day I got the thought of who I should call and got some perspective on it, and that really helped pull me out of it too. I have just absolutely fallen in love with this program, and I never thought it would ever be possible. It's something that I didn't realize was possible, and I have trouble sharing here in Springfield in certain meetings that I go to, because they don't under like it's not a common practice to talk about I'm having trouble in my job and I need to make all of these amends. And that I can wake up every morning and look forward to sitting alone in silence and meditating and praying, and being okay with, most of the things that happen on that day. I don't know. It's really, it's rooted. Annie told me this, this saying from the speaker that she heard a couple weeks ago at this WIPA, that everything that I want is hidden in all the things I don't want to do. And that has reigned true for so much of my sobriety, of being pushed by everyone to just do the most uncomfortable shit possible because it produces an effect. Everything I do produces an effect, and the effects, I'm scared. I shared about in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, like what happens when I stop having these giant spiritual experiences? It's scary, but they keep happening as long as I'm paying attention, like paying attention finally makes sense 21 months into my sobriety as I'm getting these nudges and this intuition. I'm telling people to hold me accountable on them. And I keep having these experiences to where, I've got sponsees that are pretty early on. And I honestly have trouble identifying, and I get way ahead of myself because, in the beginning, like I couldn't stay sober. And that was the main point of being sober. I didn't ask for anything else except the obsession to be removed, and it's so much more has opened me up with that today to when like I pay attention to just what I think God wants me to know. But I pay attention to how my family's feeling, what they need, where my sponsees are at, what they're doing, what I can do at work. And all of this is a major result of my amends and actually asking people how I affected them and what more I could do to make it right. And the majority of them just want me present. They want me there. They don't want me to spout off all these great things that I think I know. And going to a sponsee and trying to, articulate like the best way I can that these are, these steps are a map, from the prison of your own mind, to the great reality deep within, and it starts in my head and it ends in my heart, but there's a lot of stuff that goes on in between there. I never thought it was possible, and I mostly thank this group for it, for opening me up to what real recovery looks like, and not being concerned with how I feel, but concerned with my resistance and my fears, and the importance of walking through those, the importance of fellowship and a sponsorship family, and phone calls, and prayer, and meditation, and steps, and more discussion. I'm not a strict sponsor. I just suggest that they do all those things basically in that order, or you will get an effect. And so hopefully, I softened up over time. I'm coming to an end, and I picked out this reading. It's a supplement to 24 hours a day, and it's called Stumbling in the Right Direction. And I read it on February 6th, and I wanted to end with this. Once I talked about the program, and it says, "Good morning. Our keynote is to pray, to seek, to love, comfort, and understand." Said according to the for the meditation of the day, God finds amid the crowd a few people who persistently seek to live in the presence of the divine. It reminds me of a conversation my original sponsor had with Bill Wilson. Bill said about 90% of the people who succeed in AA do enough to stay sober and have good lives. Those folks are indeed good AA members, Bill said. But he continued, about 5% want it all. They want all possible peace, spirituality, and harmony with God and their fellows. I suspect this divide applies to all who profess spirituality, not just AA members. From the day I heard that story, I have longed to be part of that 5%. I am convinced that whether I am part of the 5% or the 95% at any given time depends primarily on my behavior that day. To have a chance of experiencing the magic of being in the 5%, I must remain conscious of God, treat my fellows well, and stitched as the divine spark directs. It moved me, and I really feel glad and confident I'm part of that 5% today, and that is the work of God, and that is the work of the sponsorship family in my life. Thank you.
Awesome. Awesome. Awesome.